Hello, and welcome to the MDS podcast, the official podcast of the International Parkinson's and Movement Disorder Society. My name is Mitra Afshari. I'm an associate editor of the MDS podcast series and a movement disorder neurologist and DBS specialist in Chicago, Illinois, in the United States. And today we're very excited to have Dr. Patricia Krauser and Andrea Kuhn with us from Charité Hospital in Berlin, Germany. Patricia and Andrea are the first author and the senior author, respectively, of the research article we'll be discussing today, Long-Term Outcomes of Palatal Neurostimulation for Dystonia, a Controlled Prospective 10-Year Follow-Up. This was published in the June 2025 issue of Movement Disorders. So welcome, Patricia and Andrea. Thank you both for taking the time to join us today to discuss this very important contribution to the DBS literature.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
So in this article, the authors present the findings from a 10-year follow-up study of globus pallidus interna, GPI, DBS, and treatment-refractory isolated dystonia patients that were implanted across 10 centers in Australia, Norway, and Germany. The original parent trial enrolled 40 patients aged 14 to 75 and followed them prospectively. In this extension study, the authors were able to specifically look at the motor and disability outcomes of 31 of those 40 original patients and also take a broader look at DBS non-responders and the safety profiles over time. And so all in all, the goal of this work is to provide more evidence for the question, what is the durability of DBS for dystonia, specifically isolated generalized and isolated segmental dystonia, and how safe is it long term? So to set the stage, Patricia, I think our audience is familiar with the phenomenology of dystonia, but could you briefly review the definitions of isolated generalized dystonia and isolated segmental dystonia, and give us kind of a review of how those two patient populations tend to differ?
Yes, I'd like to. So when you talk about isolated dystonia in general, this is a movement disorder that is characterized by involuntary muscle contraction of body parts or the whole body. And this is the difference between the two forms of generalized or segmental dystonia. So you have muscle contractions of the whole body in generalized dystonia or adjacent bearing body parts in segmental dystonia. And you may also have tremor, but no additional other feature in dystonia, and it relies on the clinical presentation and exclusion of other underlying disorders to define dystonia, an isolated dystonia.
And when it comes to generalized dystonia patients versus segmental dystonia patients, do the ages of these patients tend to differ? Do they present at different times?
Absolutely. So generalized dystonia usually starts in the childhood. Very often children start to have difficulties walking, limping, and then dystonia spreading over the body. Patients start to develop symptoms already at the age of 4, 5, 6. And segmental or even focal dystonias tend to appear later in the stage of development, more often around the end of 20s, 30s, 40s.
Right. So in general, generalized dystonia can be more of a child onset, segmental, more of an adult onset. While some of our listeners are familiar with these statistics that we quote in terms of kind of the general percentage improvement one sees in dystonia following GPI DBS, some of our listeners may not be. Can you remind us what previous meta-analyses have shown in terms of the motoric benefit of palatal stimulation in the short term, like 6 months to a year, and also the data that we had previous to this study in the long term beyond a year? Can you remind us of that information?
So in dystonia, it's always a bit difficult to really foresee individual benefits of deep brain stimulation. And this is something that we were able to show that we can achieve up to 56-70% of improvement with palatal deep brain stimulation in dystonia, but it is really depending on some facts. Is there a genetic background which might help to respond to DBS? How long do you have dystonia? Is there already fixed or mobile dystonia features? And so it depends. There is, as our work shows, proof that it's a very long-lasting and enduring treatment for patients for dystonia, but there are mixed results.
Thank you for that. The jumping right into your study and the motor outcomes. So your analysis was able to show that from baseline to 10 years, there was about a 56% improvement in dystonia motor scores for both types of dystonia, for the generalized dystonia patients and for the segmental dystonia patients. And this was measured by the Burke von Marsden dystonia scale. And this improvement was unchanged from what was seen at 6 months and at 5 years, again, indicating that the benefit was sustained over 10 years. And similarly, you were also able to show sustained benefit over 10 years when you looked at two other patient-reported variables or scales of dystonia severity, the Burke von Marsden disability score and a simple visual analog scale of dystonia severity. And then when you separated out the two patient populations, the generalized versus the segmental dystonia patients, the improvement seen was similar. So Dr. Kuhn, Andrea, what do these findings mean to you, and how do these findings translate into your clinical practice and not only who you consider as DBS candidates, but also how does this translate into how you counsel patients who are considering DBS?
Sure, it's very important. And as we pointed out at the beginning, generalized dystonia occurs also already in childhood. It is the long-term outcomes really important for these children because it depends on how well they can attend school and have their independent life. So it's not about 5 years or even not about 10 years, but much longer time span that we have to look at. And so it's very promising that we could show in this study that after 10 years, we have still a significant effect of palliative stimulation and there's no significant reoccurrence of symptoms. So when we counsel our patients, especially also the parents of these children, we can tell them already now that the long-term outcome is very positive for palliative stimulation.
And also, I think we were alluding to this before, the classic teaching is that younger patients with kind of more distal distribution of dystonia respond the best to GPI DBS compared to older patients who may have more of the axial or midline dystonia symptoms. And do you think that these findings of your study kind of challenges that initial notion?
I think we could show that in general, it is a very effective therapy. And still we know that symptoms in the limb respond maybe better to DBS, so that's not to be ignored. But we know that there are many different influencing factors. So it's not only the symptom distribution, it's also whether it's phasic or tonic contraction. It's about the genotype. So there, it's also the time lived with dystonia, which is important. So in this respect, it's important to know that we should operate on the children rather early and not wait too long, because they might get orthopedic complications of their dystonia over time. And so there's still a lot of research to be done to really understand the pathophysiological underlying of the effects of DBS in dystonia. But I think from a clinical perspective, we could show that it's the best therapy we have for generalized dystonia when they are not responsive to medication.
So before we turn to the detailed analysis regarding the DBS non-responders, I'd like to discuss some of the important secondary findings with respect to the non-motor outcomes. So specifically, you guys looked at the improvement from baseline in anxiety, depression, cognition, and pain. And you were able to find a statistically significant reduction in pain as measured by a patient-reported visual analog scale of pain. And I think that's important because in dystonia, we're taught that dystonia is inherently a painless phenomenon, but many of our patients, especially a lot of our older patients with cervical dystonia do experience a lot of pain, perhaps because there's other muscles that are compensating for the dystonic movements. You showed that anxiety and depression improved from baseline to 10 years, but that was not statistically significant. And there was no statistically significant change in cognition from baseline, which was actually a positive finding. Dr. Kuhn, what are your kind of takeaways from these 10-year results of the non-motor symptoms associated with dystonia?
Well, I think overall, this is also a very positive outcome. So as you pointed out, there's no change in cognition, which is positive. There's an improvement in pain, and often this improvement in pain occurs very early. So we know that dystonic symptoms disappear only after weeks or even sometimes months of deep brain stimulation, and pain symptoms can respond quite quickly. And it's important to see that's a sustained phenomenon, that they don't suffer from pain after 10 years of stimulation as well. And improvement in depressive symptoms, so I don't think it's so much a direct effect of the neurostimulation, but it's of course related to the symptom relief that the patients experience over all this time with palliative stimulation.
Absolutely. So it's important in any DBS study to take a deep dive into non-responders and kind of hypothesize what led to less than ideal outcomes. Is it something to do with the disease and the candidate itself, basically, or has it something to do with the procedure? And so by elucidating those details, we can refine our processes. Dr. Kuhn, for our listeners who may not be as familiar with DBS research, what are kind of the general themes that come up when you're looking at DBS non-responders? And by non-responders, we define that specifically as less than or equal to 25% motor improvement. Is that correct?
Yes, for this study, we defined it as 25%, and that's what most studies did so far. And it's a mixture of different aspects that we have to take into account. Of course, one prerequisite is the good selection of patients. So we initially, Patricia clarified what isolated dystonia means. And here we had the chance also after 10 years of further disease development, sometimes disease progression, we reviewed the videos of our patients and we realized that in some patients, there were additional motor features, so they were possibly not isolated dystonia cases. And we know that isolated dystonia patients often respond less well to DBS. If you have selected the right patients, like isolated dystonia, still there can be quite a big variability in responsiveness. And another prerequisite is a good electrode placement. So we didn't systematically look at this because this study was initially started in the early 2000s. And we have now gained a lot of knowledge since then about the hotspot for palliative stimulation. That would be an important aspect to take into consideration in the future. We know that there's a higher variability in DBS response, for example, in patients with TAP mutations who did six mutation carriers in comparison to did one mutation carrier. We already talked about the distribution of the symptoms or whether it's tonic or phasic movements, and often phasic movements respond faster and also sometimes better to DBS. So these were different aspects that we could show in our study that influence whether or not they are non-responders.
Thank you. That was a good review. So in this cohort, your group found 13 non-responders. That's about one-third of the original sample of the 40 patients. And then of those 13, the vast majority, I think about 10 out of 13, which is over 75%, were thought to be due to a secondary treatment failure. And then the remaining three were thought to be due to a primary treatment failure, meaning, like you mentioned, the patient's underlying condition may not have been very responsive to DBS. So let's discuss the secondary treatment failures. It seems like 6 to 7 of the 13 non-responders, that's more than half of the non-responders, the DBS leads were not optimally placed when you looked at postoperative imaging. And in one patient, the patient actually improved after a revision surgery. So, Tricia, I know it may be hard to say because these patients were not your personal patients, but knowing what you know of the retrospective chart review and the video review of the patients, would you hypothesize that more optimal lead placement in these patients could have potentially led to a more favorable response? Or is it hard to say because, as you mentioned, at the time, these patients were not systematically getting imaging for all of the patients. There was no systematic genetic testing for all of the patients. Is it kind of hard to say?
Yeah, you're totally right. So it is a very individualized way to find out why someone did not respond. And this is what we try to learn from it. And this is also something that we try to show very comprehensively in one of the tables where we really checked on each non-responder. And you're totally right that image-guided lead positioning genetic testing was not part of the trial in the beginning. And additionally, the definition of isolated dystonias came years after the trial was started. And when we check on our patients, there are, of course, some patients who really did not have optimal lead positioning that we investigated afterwards. And we found some gene mutations, such as TAP1 gene mutation that Andrea already mentioned. But we also could, for example, deduce from this patient who benefited from the revision of the electrodes that he then showed DYT1 or TOR1A gene mutation, which is associated with better outcome after DBS. And then with this gene mutation and revision of the electrodes benefited very well from the method outside the study.
Wonderful. I mean, that being said, Patricia, in your clinic, how do you approach dystonia patients who have GPI-DBS who aren't getting the benefit would have expected? Do you have a particular workflow? Do you first check the imaging, then think about sending genetic testing? And for the patients who do have favorable genetics, do you have like a low threshold to consider revision surgery? Because I think it differs from institution to institution. Some DBS specialists are very reluctant to kind of revise and go back into the brain, whereas other DBS specialists and neurosurgeons who have seen good outcomes from revision surgery have a much lower threshold.
Yes, again, this is a very individual process. Already in the evaluation process, we try to find out whether there are hints for any genetic association for dystonia to just define the disease more properly and then perhaps get a hint for a good response. But even with a gene mutation that might perhaps not benefit from it, we, for example, have a family treated with deep brain stimulation. All three patients from one family suffering from TAP1 gene mutation, and that we had two responders and one non-responder with the same gene mutation. So it was a very individual response to the method. And we tend to discuss more beneficial situations with the patient and to make the communication about the DBS very individualized, but still would give it a try. After stimulation, where we have the feeling that the patient is not getting all of the treatment that we wish, we, of course, really diligently check for the lead position and try to adapt stimulation settings and to try out new stimulation settings. Also, keeping in mind that we can have adverse effects of the deep brain stimulation with capsular effects mimicking dystonic symptoms, for example, or bradykinesia being induced by deep brain stimulation, and to take this into account as well in order to improve stimulation results. And to the second part of your question, yes, when we have the feeling that there is someone who might benefit from deep brain stimulation and the localization is not well put, we will, after a diligent testing of stimulation parameters, discuss the implantation with patients and hope to find a better way of treatment.
Wonderful. That was a really important perspective, especially what you mentioned about that family with the TAP1 dystonia. So even with that same mutation, there was clinical heterogeneity and differences in response. So there's a lot of research that still needs to be done. It looks like amongst the non-responders in your study, there were three patients who did not have true isolated dystonia. So they may not have been ideal candidates because of the underlying process that was going on. And two patients, as you mentioned, had the THAP1 dystonia. Andrea, could you explain for our listeners, what is the thinking behind the variable response when it comes to isolated dystonia versus a non-isolated dystonia, where there may be a potential, I'm assuming, neurodegeneration at play underneath? Can you give kind of a general overview of what the thinking is behind that?
We still don't understand entirely the pathophysiology of dystonia, but isolated dystonia, that's a non-regenerative process. So there's abnormal plasticity, there's abnormal inhibition on different cortical levels in the basal ganglia and even on the spinal level. But the patients that present, for example, with additional ataxia or spasticity, that's most likely within a more complex disorder where multiple systems are involved and there's degeneration that's going on. So there might be some cerebellar atrophy. It might be one of the scars that only develop a bit later in life, starting to present with dystonia, but then later developing also ataxia, like in one of our patients. So this is different to the abnormalities found in isolated dystonia. Well, our thinking behind it is that the rhythmicity is changed, so the pattern of output of the basal ganglia is changed in dystonia, and that can be suppressed as abnormal signaling, for example, with deep brain stimulation. And that gives a chance for also compensatory processes to take over, and that can help to restore a normal motor program, for example. But when the underlying process is neurodegeneration, there are different circuits involved and it's a different pathophysiology, and there the outcome is less favorable. Also after lesion, for example, like in cerebral palsy patients, due to lesions in the basal ganglia, we don't get the same results as in isolated dystonia.
Thank you so much. That was really important to hear that. So we mentioned before that not all of the 40 patients in this cohort were systematically genetically tested. Has the group thought about going back and potentially testing these patients, or have you discussed how this should be prioritized in your current studies, your future studies?
I think it's something where we learn more and more over the years. It has developed in some of the disorders or some of the types of dystonia, like KMT2B mutation only has been found some years ago, so later than this study was initiated. So I think for the future, it's very important to have the genetic status, if the patient agrees, from all our patients, to learn more about how a genotype relates to DBS outcome. But we also have to keep in mind that there's quite a big genotype, phenotype variability. And also in the response to DBS, there's a high variability. So we should not make straightforward conclusions that, for example, patients with a TAMP1 mutation with DYT6 don't respond to DBS. They respond with a higher variability, but that shouldn't exclude patients from undergoing the treatment. But the more evidence we have, the better we can counsel our patients, of course.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And I would perhaps even add that you already mentioned reduction of pain as a result of deep brain stimulation. Sometimes we have patients where we cannot really say they improved with 25% or more regarding the motor symptoms, but they would clearly state that they benefit from deep brain stimulation with regard to pain and quality of life, and even smaller amounts of improvement sometimes decide on whether a child, for example, can go to a school or not and have another way of participating in life. And these plain motor scores we sometimes need to present, but the more individualized results of deep brain stimulation sometimes are harder to convey.
Absolutely. I think you guys are both highlighting that DBS care has to be very personalized, as we've mentioned. finally, we want to discuss the final important analysis of the study, which was looking in detail at the long-term safety profile of GPI-DBS for these patients. And it looks like comparing the total number of adverse events and serious adverse events during the first 5 years of treatment to the latter 5 years of treatment, there was twice as many events in the short term versus the long term. Between years 5 to 10, there are about 17 serious adverse events. And I believe 4 of them were infections. Patricia, how do these infection rates compare to what you've seen in practice and what has been documented before in the DBS literature?
Yeah, so yes, totally right. We had approximately 43% less adverse events in comparison to the 6 month and 5 year observation period, which is really encouraging, we have to say, as we have, again, a disease that has to be treated for a lifelong term. And so we see when the therapy is working, we do not need to expect adverse events or serious adverse events in the long run. These two whole system infections and two infections of the implantable pulse generator are in line with the published AESAE percentage and will always be a topic and have to be educated on symptoms to come to the clinics. Maybe when you have these long-term treatment, you sometimes perhaps tend to go to the doctor a bit late. This is something that we still have. We have to follow up the patients. But all in all, these numbers have been really encouraging.
I agree. And then of the AEs, the adverse events, the most frequently reported adverse event, both in the short term and the long term, seem to be dysarthria. So Patricia or Andrea, what's your take on this finding? I think this is interesting because when we counsel PD patients who go on to get GPI-DBS, we don't necessarily hone in on speech as a symptom that will inevitably come under threat with long-term DBS. Is this something that you guys are looking a little bit more into? Is it more a reflection of the dystonia? And do you feel like it's more a reflection of the stimulation and stimulation-induced side effect?
Yes, I think it's a stimulation-induced side effect. It's one of the most common side effects with palliative stimulation. And in dystonia, often we use quite high voltages of stimulation. So we need the stimulation volume and the higher amplitudes in these patients for an effective relief of motor symptoms. And that sometimes comes with a slight dysarthria. And that's a bothersome symptom for patients. So sometimes you have to find a compromise between relief of motor symptoms and occurrence of side effects. But we also have to keep in mind that all these patients, they have the standard electrode that were implanted 20 years ago. So, and now with the segmented leads, we are more flexible in shaping the electrical field, and it could be a side effect that occurs less often with the technical advancement that we also have for DBS.
I agree. I think, like you mentioned, with dystonia patients, the amplitudes tend to be much higher than what you would see in Parkinson's patients.
We really had patients that accepted higher amplitudes rather than an improvement of dysarthria because of the benefit for their dystonic
symptoms. For the dystonia, exactly. So finally, to conclude this incredible discussion and kind of look a little bit towards the future, I would like to open up to either of you. We're now in this era of adaptive DBS, where we can deliver stimulation only when the brain signals tell us that it's needed. So do you think that there is a place for adaptive DBS for dystonia patients? Perhaps, like we were mentioning, reducing some of these stimulation-related side effects like the dysarthria. Or is dystonia and the DBS effect just different than what we see in PD patients, where we really need the stimulation to be chronic, we need it to be consistent in order to have that intended effect on the network? What are your thoughts on that?
So I think adaptive stimulation is mainly for patients. The motor symptoms are fluctuating, and we have this more prominent maybe in Parkinson's disease, but we also only are at the beginning of trying adaptive stimulation in clinical routine. So we have been one of the first centers here in Europe with adaptive stimulation, and we have now a small cohort of Parkinson patients on adaptive stimulation with very positive results. And it's only certified also for Parkinson patients so far, and not yet for dystonia. So it's not possible to switch dystonia patients on adaptive stimulation. As you explained, it's based on a biomarker, so on oscillatory activity from the brain, and that has been very well studied in Parkinson's disease with beta activity. And we also have done a lot of studies in dystonia focusing on lower frequencies like theta alpha activity that is enhanced with enhanced motor symptoms in dystonia. So we would have, let's say, a hint on which biomarker to follow for adaptive stimulation, but it's not that well studied for dystonia. And there are also some other pitfalls and difficulties. So we have still some issues, for example, with movement artifacts for adaptive stimulation. And we definitely have more involuntary movements in dystonia when comparing it to Parkinson's disease. And you have to imagine also that you stimulate with several milliamps, but the typical activity of the brain is microvolts. And the stimulation amplitude that we use, as we discussed before, in dystonia is also much higher. So artifacts from the stimulation, to suppress these artifacts, also more difficult in dystonia patients, which we learned from some previous chronic recordings in dystonia. So I think it's still a bit of a way to get there, but it's certainly an option that we should try with respect to side effects like dysarthria and taking into consideration dystonia patients with phasic movements that could be also modulated accordingly with DBS. So I think it's an interesting topic and a potential option in the future, but it still needs a little bit of research before we can start it in clinical routine.
Tricia, do you have any thoughts on that as well?
I'm just very curious whether, for instance, with the first use of adaptive electrodes, we might see different patterns in between patients and after deep brain stimulation in the first period of time and after longer times, whether these patterns might help us to see whether there is a biomarker in dystonia which can lead us to an individualized therapy as well.
I understand what you're saying. So to use it as a means to learn a little bit more from the dystonia patients. Tricia, Andrea, this was really excellent. I really enjoyed this discussion. I want to thank you for lending your time, your expertise so generously to this podcast. And more importantly, I want to thank you for all of the work you're doing for our dystonia patients. And to our listeners, thank you for tuning in to my first podcast as part of the MDS podcast. I hope that you enjoyed it. Thank you so much and bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thank you.
If you enjoyed the conversation about this paper, you can further your experience with continuing medical credits, or CMEs. You can find the link to the journal CME course for this paper within the episode description on the MDS website. Journal CME is planned and implemented in accordance with the accreditation requirements of the Accreditation Council for Continuing Medical Education, ACCME. The International Parkinson and Movement Disorder Society is accredited by the ACCME to provide a continuing medical education for physicians. The International Parkinson and Movement Disorder Society designates this education activity for a maximum of 1 AMA PRA Category 1 credits. The views and opinions expressed by the participants in this podcast do not necessarily reflect those of the International Parkinson and Movement Disorder Society or their affiliated journals, Movement Disorders, and Movement Disorders Clinical Practice. Any disclosures of the participants can be found within the episode description located on the MDS website.